You ready?
Yeah, I'm all set.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We've got a really interesting one for you guys today. We have Andrew Lowney with us, who has run his own literary agency since 1988. He is a trustee of the Campaign for Freedom of Information and president of the Biographers Club. He's written for The Times, Telegraph, Wall Street Journal, Spectator and The Guardian. He wrote a brilliant biography of Guy Burgess, but his latest book, The Mountbattens, is the Daily Mail's biography of the year. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello, nice to be here.
Do you know what? I think we should just jump straight in with these questions. So could you start by telling us which two Mountbattens your book title refers to? Because who is Uncle Dickie? Because our knowledge of him is entirely based on World War One and the name change and what happened to his father. We believe he was at Dartmouth, and at one point there was a rumour that his dad had been arrested. So tell us how he becomes a Mountbatten and about World War One.
Yes, the two characters are Dickie Mountbatten, Prince Philip's uncle, born in 1900, and his wife Edwina, born in 1901. Dickie was the great-grandson of Queen Victoria, and his father, Prince Louis of Battenberg, was in fact the First Lord of the Admiralty. First Sea Lord, and he was forced to resign in the First World War because of anti-German feeling. The family, in fact, later changed their name from Battenberg to Mountbatten. And so that's why the stories have risen about him being arrested. He wasn't arrested, but he did resign. And in fact, this was one of the things that really drove his son to his ambition to become First Sea Lord himself, which he did almost exactly 40 years later. And when the two got married in 1922, they were regarded as one of the most glamorous couples in Britain. Something like 8,000 people came to their wedding, which was at St. Margaret's in the shadow of Westminster Abbey. The Prince of Wales, future King Edward VIII, was the best man. The King George V and Queen Mary were among the guests. And it made drew headlines around the world. There were indeed special supplements listing the wedding presents and various things. And you can actually see on YouTube a Pathé newsreel of the wedding. So they were both extremely good looking. She at the time was the richest heiress in the world. And there were some concerns that Dickie was a bit of a gold digger, which in the end proved to be unfounded. But they were a remarkable couple. And of course, quite soon after the marriage, she began to have affairs. According to her daughter, she had 18 lovers in the course of the marriage. I've only found 16 so far. She was certainly a woman ahead of her time, shall we say.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how World War One comes into this?
Well, I mean, first of all, the First World War, Dickie is at Dartmouth, as you say. He just misses fighting at Jutland, where his older brother George is actually a young midshipman. And the First World War, I suppose, is important because the royal family, which is German, has to change its name to the House of Windsor. As I say, the Mountbattens become Mountbattens from Battenberg. So it's quite a traumatic point. And I think one of the interesting things I found in the course of researching the book is that Dickie's sort of background, his antecedents, were very important to him. He felt, I think, very vulnerable because he wasn't actually a Prince of Hesse. His grandfather had had a morganatic marriage. But he was certainly brought up amongst the crown heads of Europe. His uncle was the Tsar Nicholas II. He himself had childhoods with the Russian royal family and was very fond of particularly Princess Marie. So he was a much more cosmopolitan figure than many of the sort of, certainly all the naval officers of his generation. But he was clearly going to the top. After the First World War, he went to Cambridge for a couple of terms. There he became very friendly with the future King George VI and Prince Henry, and through them with Prince Edward. And one of the first things he did as a young naval midshipman was to act as ADC to the future King Edward VIII on his tours around the world. And that relationship that Dickie had really with the royal family, which went right back to Queen Victoria, he was her last godchild, continued right through to Prince Charles. He was not only a very close friend, he called him his greatest friend, of King Edward VIII, but very close to King George VI and then to the Queen, and Prince Charles always called him his honorary grandfather.
So coming back to the relationship between Dickie and Edwina, tell us how they got together, because was it a love match?
Well, yes, it was a love match. They met at Cowes in 1921. And very quickly got married. They got engaged, in fact, in India when he was on one of his tours. And in the spring of 1922 and married in July 1922. And it's one of those extraordinary marriages which, though it was beset with infidelities on both sides, was a very loving one, supportive one. And the various lovers became in some ways honorary parents to the two girls, Pamela and Patricia. So that's what I call, why I called it the lives and loves, because though they had very distinguished public lives, they also had these very different private lives to most people. And Dickie was a very unjealous person. He only was concerned that his reputation wasn't affected with the royal family and his career wasn't affected. So as long as Edwina was discreet, as she always wasn't, then he was happy. And indeed, she really wasn't a good mother. So after Patricia was born in 1924 and Pamela in 1929, she pretty much abandoned them to governesses and went traveling the world with friends, including her bisexual sister-in-law, Nada Milford Haven. And they did the most extraordinary things, camping in the Middle East across the desert, traveling by horseback across South America. They drove, she was the first woman to drive down the Burma-China Road. She went with one of her lovers, Bunny Phillips, across the South Seas in a small junk. She was incredibly adventurous and I suppose very unusual woman. And as I said, ahead of her time, she had the money, she had the time to do these things. But she certainly didn't behave like a conventional wife of a naval officer.
I have to say, I think I would love to go travelling with her. She sounds like a right barrel of laughs.
Yes, she was fun. And I think one of the interesting things I discovered is that it's really a book of two halves. She's in many ways looking for a purpose in life. She has a lot of money, has a lot of time, and nothing really to do with it, apart from a brief job during the general strike in 1926. She's just a lady of leisure. She's highly intelligent, not really properly educated, very much a sort of product of her time. It's only really the war that gives her some sort of job and purpose and validation, particularly validation in the eyes of her husband. And at that point, the whole thing changes. Though she continues to have lovers and lead a pretty exciting private life, she is driven by a very strong sense of duty, as he was. And she becomes, in some ways, the heroine of the book. There's no one I found who had a harsh word to say against her after the Second World War. She becomes this humanitarian figure who is devoted to her charity work with St. John Ambulance and Save the Children.
So, the Second World War, he's, of course, Mountbatten of Burma. Can you tell us why?
Yes, what happened, the war makes Dickie. He at the beginning of the war, he's in charge of a destroyer flotilla. But he's a terrible captain. He's torpedoed. He's sunk several times and often by disobeying orders. But Churchill realizes that he shouldn't leave him at sea. It's too dangerous. But that he has innate qualities of leadership. His connections to the royal family are very good. He gets on with the Americans. And he sort of thinks outside the box. And so he makes him head of the combined operations, which are basically a team of sort of commandos who mount operations against occupied Europe, of which the most famous raid is the Dieppe raid of 1942, a rather controversial one. But Dickie proves himself a great success at combined operations. And as a result of that, in 1943, he's made the Supreme Allied Commander of Southeast Asia, which is, in a sense, the equivalent of Eisenhower here in Europe. The job has to go to a British person because the Americans have Europe. And Dickie gets the job after several other people turn it down. And again, he proves himself a very able political operator, very good at getting on with people. And particularly at the end of the war, when a lot of the nationalist parties move into the gap that's left by the retreating empires in Southeast Asia, there's a vacuum there. And many people want to go back to the status quo. They want to restore the previous governors, for example, the governor of Burma. But Dickey realizes that that's no longer possible. He's always been very friendly with Attlee. And as a result of this friendship with Attlee and these very progressive views, when there's a need for a new Viceroy of India in 1947, Dickey is appointed. And he goes out in March 1947 with Edwina. At that point, they've been on the point of divorce, but again, the public life brings them together. And he sees the problems in India, that the British authority is waning, that they can no longer really hold it together. The Indian Civil Service hasn't had any new appointments for many years. The army wants to come home. The Indians are getting impatient. There's been quite a lot of communal violence. And he makes the very controversial decision that independence will be brought forward from June 1948 to August 1947, so only a few months hence. He also realizes that the hopes of United Ireland, which had always been the intention, are going to be impossible. Jinnah, the leader of the Muslims, is determined that they will have their own homeland, and therefore India is split. And this, of course, causes problems because there already are huge communal tensions. There are worries that when the country is divided, that Muslims will not be, their interests will not be protected in the Hindu side and vice versa. And that, of course, proves to be the case. And I think one of the tragedies, something like 1 million people died in August 1947, is that there wasn't better preparation. The British were determined to go out on a high. They wanted basically to leave the Indians to sort out their problems. And that's what they did. So the boundaries were only announced the day after the independence celebrations. And as a result, there was mass panic. Trains were going between both sides, the Indian and Muslim part, the Hindu and Muslim part. And of course, they were easily targeted by the various groups. And often you'd see a train arrive in a station with everyone on board butchered. So the verdict of his time in India is sort of mixed. Some people say that he had no choice and that he at least got us out. Others say that if he had been less impatient, there would have been less bloodshed and there wouldn't be the intractable problems that remain of places like Kashmir.
Can you tell us about what Edwina went through during the war?
Yes, Edwina joined the St. John Ambulance and rose to become the head of it during the war. She was highly attractive, very intelligent, very good speaker, and she was often used on fundraising initiatives. She and Dickey went off to the States, for example, in 1941 before war broke out, before war was declared by America. She did enormous amount of traveling, and Dickey brought her out at the end of the war to work in Southeast Asia. She was often one of the first into the Japanese prisoner of war camps, even before the soldiers themselves liberated the camps. She was incredibly brave and did an extremely good job there. As she did in India, she realized that there needed to be more nurses, that the position of women needed to be better, more respected. So she was a sort of early feminist in many respects. She carried on this humanitarian work after the war, almost as if she had to make up for her misspent youth. And this, I think, drove her to an early death. It was on one of these tours in the spring of 1960 that she suddenly complained of feeling ill one evening. The next morning, her secretary went in, she was in Borneo, went in to wake her up and found that she died in the course of the night. And around her were spread the love letters of Nehru. Nehru was the Hindu leader with whom she had fallen in love while they were in India. And that relationship, really, from 1947, continued until her death in 1960. It was a very intense relationship. I quote some of their love letters. And when she died, she wanted to be buried at sea. Dickey allowed Nehru to send a frigate to also throw a wreath into the water with his wreath. Dickey was extremely, as I say, generous to her lovers. He treated them as equals. They were bound together by their devotion to her, and he never made a fuss. She had a whole series of quite famous lovers. After the war, they included Sir Malcolm Sargent, the composer and conductor. And during the war, a man called, who was the head of CBS, called Bill Paley. Something like 8,000 people, I've seen the letters, wrote to Dickey on her death. She was a very, very popular figure.
She sounds remarkable. I mean, there must have been something about her, not just her beauty, but something within her that attracted these men in such a passionate way.
Yeah, she was a very charismatic woman. She was very kind, very driven, very, very beautiful. As I say, very, a bit like Dickey, thought outside the box. I mean, I really found no one who, as I say, had a harsh word to say about her. And, you know, she was a remarkable woman. And as you say, these men fell in love with her. And in a way that Dickey didn't mind. He had his own lovers. He had a long-term lover called Yola Letellier, who was a French woman, married to a much older, richer, newspaper proprietor. In fact, she's supposedly the inspiration for Colette's Gigi. And then during the war, he had this very intense affair with a woman called Janie Lindsay, who had been engaged to both John F. Kennedy and David Niven. So she was a pretty alpha woman herself. And then later, after the war, there were other mistresses, particularly after Edwina died, many of whom remain alive today. So I have to be careful what I say. But he was a man, I mean, they were both people who really enjoyed life and had a zest for it. And it's incredible to see how hard they worked, often staying late into the night, preparing speeches and doing their paperwork, writing thank you letters. The people that interest me, because though they had their flaws, they were brilliant in their own way.
So Dickey would have nothing to do with the Japanese, would he? Is it right that no Japanese dignitaries were invited to his funeral?
Yes, I think he was a man who was very good at mixing with all ranks and with all races. But because of what he'd seen, the atrocities during the war based out in the Far East, he refused to have anything to do with the Japanese. He did turn up when Hirohito came on a state visit, but only because the Queen gave him a three-line whip. But absolutely, he was, it was one of the sort of three-line whips he had, that he just would have nothing to do with the Japanese.
Does he have the ego to match his career trajectory? I mean, what was he like as a person?
Well, they were both very complex and contradictory people. She not so much later on, but they could be very imperious, very difficult, very selfish. He could be incredibly rude to people and ignore people. A lot of members of staff didn't like him. Senior army officers who worked with him later as First Sea Lord and as Chief of Defence Staff really didn't have a good word to say about him. He was very duplicitous. And he was, he could be extremely difficult. He drove himself and he expected others to do the same, but he also inspired enormous loyalty from people. And he was extremely good. He was almost like a child. He was extremely good with young people, particularly good as a grandfather. But, this is again one of the challenges. You present this sort of mosaic of impressions from different people one's talked to, and they all have had a different experience of him. He was incredibly vain, but like a lot of vain people, very insecure. And I think that was partly because he felt he was an outsider. He was a German. He had not gone through the conventional public school education, though of course he'd been at Dartmouth, and at a prep school. He didn't believe in sort of being the gentleman amateur. He was the professional. You know, he played to win. So, for example, when he played polo, he trained very hard. He studied the game. He made sure that people practiced. He was just determined to win at all costs. And that was true of his career as well. And that's not really something that the British like. They like the sense of the slightly hopeless amateur. So he was not always a very popular figure with people. But that's, you know, again, part of the interest of writing about him.
Was he gay? And why did the FBI maintain a file on him?
Well, one of the discoveries I found researching the book was that the FBI kept a file on him from 1944. Now, there'd always been rumours that he was bisexual. but no one had ever really got any evidence. But I began to look at this, and the FBI file, one of the files, said that this man is a pervert with a particular interest in young boys. And there seemed to be quite a lot of FBI files on him that went right through to the 1950s. And there were very many reputable witnesses. You can't always believe everything you read in FBI files because they just record what people have said. But the wife of the Secretary of State for India, a senior intelligence officer, a society hostess, all said the same thing. And then I began to talk to people who'd worked with him. Indeed, one of the breakthroughs was a friend of mine from Cambridge whose father had been his ADC, who said that his father had been shocked to see the rent boys sent up to his quarters when he was based at NATO. And so there's a whole chapter in the book about, with accounts from these various people, including an interview with the man he had as a lover for the last 7 or 8 years of his life. He was in his 70s and this man was in his 20s. And stories began to emerge. I think the more shocking part of it was that there seems to be some truth in the fact that he also had this interest in very young boys. There are two men I interviewed who were, in effect, sex trafficked to him in Ireland and abused by him. And one of the things I found in the files was love letters from a man called Frederick Lawrence Long, who'd been his tutor when he was a teenager and, in fact, later married him. Who clearly was desperately in love with Mountbatten and I think possibly abused him. One of the problems is that as soon as I started asking for these FBI files, the FBI started destroying them, even after I asked for them.
Oh, wow.
And the files, even the private files that have been kept, have been very heavily weeded. So this Lawrence Long letter was found in the miscellaneous file from 1916. But pretty much all other evidence of that relationship has clearly been taken out. And that's, I know from talking to people and from accounts in books, that there's a lot about Mountbatten's private life, which is clearly not there in the archives and is either at Broadlands, the family home in Hampshire, or is being destroyed. Mountbatten always asked all his girlfriends to send him the love letters. He was always paranoid about them being found. And one of the reasons that I was able to quote Janie Lindsay's letters was because she refused to do that. So I think many of the women we won't know about because those letters are stuck in the archives who have been destroyed. And indeed, many of the files on him that the government should have released in this country are still closed, particularly files relating to his assassination in 1979 by the IRA, and indeed to his to many other things, including perhaps his paedophile activities. I've asked, for example, for the logs of the car numbers going into Clancybourne for the month in August 1977 when these boys were abused, which they've refused to release. As I said, there's a lot of mystery about his death. He'd always been a target for the IRA. He'd always had plenty of protection. But in 1979, it was a particularly bad time. Erin Neave had just been assassinated. The IRA had said they were going to kill a member of the royal family. He was warned not to go to Ireland, but chose to go. And for the first time, his boat, Shadow 5, which was moored in the local harbour, was not watched. And as a result, the IRA were able to plant a bomb on board, which they detonated remotely. On the last August bank holiday of 1979, blowing him up almost immediately together with other members of his family, his grandson and the grandson's friend, and Mountbatten's son-in-law's mother were all killed. But the IRA, what's interesting is that there were six people in the team, only two of them were arrested, only one of them was convicted, and he was let out quite quickly under the Good Friday Agreement and still alive. There was a man called Graham Yule, who was a military policeman, who was deputed to guard him that summer, and he did an intelligence assessment showing that the boat was vulnerable and should be guarded, and also reporting IRA activists in the area. And when he gave that report to his superiors, not only did they ignore it, but they actually told him to basically forget it, and they moved him to Hong Kong, and he claims he was forced to sign a gagging order, which only expired a few years ago. So there are a lot of mysteries about why he was left so unprotected. Mountbatten, of course, never really liked too much protection. It affected his freedom of movement, but also, of course, it curtailed his activities in Ireland with his paedophile activities. So, but there have been various rumours. Enoch Powell said the CIA were involved. There have been stories of British intelligence. Someone said the KGB supplied the bomb. The Syrians trained the bomber. So I think there's a lot more to the story than we've really know about, even though it's 40 years ago. But the files are closed, so we just don't know what really happened.
That's incredible. I wonder if they'll ever be released.
I think it's very unlikely. I mean, I've tried very hard to get them released. And I think it's very unlikely. I think a lot of files, like those FBI files, have been destroyed. A lot of material is in the Royal Archives. I know that Mountbatten left a lot of private papers there, and those certainly are closed. There's not even a catalogue of what's there. So there's still a lot of secrecy around the lives of the Mountbattens. Indeed, I'm trying at the moment to get access to their diaries and letters, which were part of this collection, which was left to Southampton University, which was left in lieu of tax, and which, from public funds, from our taxes, several million pounds were spent buying. And then when it got to Southampton, they decided to close it, without any proper legal authority. And so I'm challenging that at the moment to see if we can have access to those diaries and letters. But it's difficult to know what private letters and diaries from the 1920s can have in them that's so sensitive that now, 100 years later, we still can't read them.
So despite all of these rumours, and obviously Edwina's infidelity and also Dickie's infidelity, how powerful were they as a couple post-war?
Well, I think they were very important. I mean, he was the last Viceroy of India, first Governor General of India after that. He was probably, among the royal family, the only person to have had a really distinguished public career separate from his royal duties, ending up as Chief of Defence Staff, which is as high as you can go in the armed services. They were mixing with high society. I mean, they on their honeymoon, they mixed with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Charlie Chaplin. Their friends later on included people like Grace Kelly. They loved showbiz people. But, you know, he had the ear of various politicians. He was often brought in to chair committees. There's even a big story, which I discovered in 1968, where he thought he might actually become the figurehead behind a coup against against Harold Wilson, which has been covered up. I mean, he saw himself as a big player. She less so, and of course he didn't have her restraining influence after 1960, and I think one does get a sense of him being slightly out of control after that. You know, they remain major figures, and at his funeral, many millions around the world watched it. There were crowds of 50,000 lining the route. It made headlines around the world. I certainly remember as a young boy, the news, it's rather sort of similar to when Diana died or Kennedy died. It was that big a story. And if you think his influence on the royal family stretched really from the time of Queen Victoria to the present day, it's been said by one royal writer that he was probably the most important influence on Prince Charles. They remained very close throughout his life. Charles gave the funeral orations at his funeral and memorial service. So he had a huge impact on the royal family and indeed, you know, on the country as a whole.
Sticking with that topic, how instrumental was he in the marriage of Princess Elizabeth to his nephew Philip?
Well, one of the things about Dickie was he was a great fixer. I mean, he loved to help people, but he could be very interfering. And it's become clear from the archives that I've seen, the letters in the Royal Archives, that he and George VI basically plotted the courtship of the Queen and Prince Philip. It was Dickie who was determined to create this dynasty. He later tried to get his granddaughter Amanda to marry Prince Charles. But he, when the Queen came round Dartmouth in July 1939, it was he who got Prince Philip to show her round. this correspondence between the king and Mountbatten, showing them, pushing that relationship along. I mean, clearly there was an attraction, particularly on the side of the queen, bringing them together. They made sure that Philip, who was basically a sort of Greek, Danish, German prince, had his naturalization done, that he joined the navy, that he was prepared to be acceptable to the British public. His sisters were married to Nazi officers. And so there was a real sort of preparation. They could see there was an attraction there, and they pushed along. And often Philip fought against that and the interference. And that was to be true throughout his life. But Dickie would, for example, let Philip bring his girlfriends during the war down to Broadlands and stay there. He did the same with Charles later. You can see their names in the visitor's book. And he did a lot to push to matchmake people, because he wanted people to be happy. He believed in those sort of family connections. Remember, he'd come from that generation where people just did marry within their circle, within their family. And so I think he's a very important influence. And of course, he was determined that when the Queen married Prince Philip took the Mountbatten name. In 1947, he was naturalized, and that Mountbatten name would carry on. It would be the House of Mountbatten. And when that happened in 1952, when George VI died, everyone was appalled, because, of course, it was only a few years since the First World War, and they'd created the House of Windsor. And Churchill and various people made a huge stink about it. And the Queen was forced to issue a proclamation saying that, no, now that she was Queen, she was still the House of Windsor. But eventually, a compromise was found, and so they're now known as the House of Mountbatten Windsor. So, for example, Meghan and Harry's son Archie is a Mountbatten Windsor.
So, coming back to Edwina, she dies quite young, doesn't she?
Yes, she's only in her 50s when she dies. She died on this tour in Borneo, probably from hard work. She'd really been pushing herself. She was doing these tours around the world all the time, always on the go. She'd had some medical problems. And I think it was exhaustion. Her heart couldn't cope. I mean, she literally just conked out. I mean, there have been various rumors that she took drugs, that she had various sexually transmitted diseases, that her immune system was weak. And there may be something there. Who knows? Again, that's material that has been closed. So we just don't know. We don't know what the autopsy said when she died. So we can only speculate. But he was absolutely shattered by it. I mean, though they'd had their separate lives, they'd by that stage become very much not just a public team, but had been brought together. Their private life was much happier. And so it was a tragedy for him when that happened. But who knows? When I go out and give talks, often people pop up in the audience with stories about her. Or, for example, someone popped up the other day who was the daughter of a doctor who's treated her for sex addiction in the 1920s. So there's clearly a lot of material that I didn't find that is really with people and their memories, but hopefully will not be lost when they die, but may eventually emerge.
So career-wise, what does Dickie do after India, and what are the Harold Wilson conspiracy theories?
Well, when he comes back from India in 1948, he's determined to carry on and become First Sea Lord. He goes to Malta as Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean, and eventually comes back as First Sea Lord. He's there during Suez. He's very opposed to the Suez landings and threatens to resign. He eventually becomes Chief of the Defence Staff and retires in 1965 after a career of over 50 years in the armed services. But he remains active in lots of organisations. He's Governor of the Isle of Wight. He is involved with something like over 100 organisations, both charitable and service. You often see him on the Trooping of the Colour, for example. So he remains extremely active. He gets his papers in order. He supports various biographies that paint him in an attractive light. He makes a very ambitious 12-part series about his life, filming around the world for 2 years, Life and Times. And so he's very active. As I say, the situation in 1968 with Harold Wilson is there was a huge concern, particularly among the intelligence services, but also the army and the city, that the country was going to the dogs, that Wilson really wasn't in control, that he was actually a Soviet agent. He certainly had Soviet agents around him. And they tried to pull together a coup against him, which was a mixture of politicians, people from the army, people from industry and the civil service. And Mountbatten was approached to basically be the figurehead. Now, the public version is that he refused, said this is rank treachery. But I saw in various correspondence that he was persuaded, he had this huge ego, to go quite a long way down the line until he realized, you know, this was treachery, and the Queen basically said, you mustn't do this. But he put forward various people for this cabinet, including a great friend of his who was the head of the Hammer horror films, a man called Jimmy Carreras. But various people like Douglas Hume and Roy Jenkins were put forward as this government of all the talents. So it's an extraordinary episode which really hasn't been written about, again, because the participants have destroyed their papers. And it was only by triangulating the correspondence between the various people that I was able to see where the gaps were. But, I mean, there are huge gaps in 1968 where they've clearly destroyed their papers or certainly not made them available to any public archive.
I really need to say I'm finding Edwina far more appealing than Dickie.
Yes, I think that's right. And I know she should have a film made of her, just her own life. You know, he could be very difficult and, say, very vain. You know, she had her faults, but I think that, you know, she was this free spirit. And, you know, in her youth, that wasn't really allowed. But later on, she... you know, was able to sort of spread her wings a bit. She had they both actually had a penchant for people of color. She had a long affair with a singer called Leslie Hutchinson, and also a brief affair with the actor Paul Robeson. And of course, Nehru was an Indian. And Dickie was the same. He was attracted to people from Southeast Asia, perhaps as a result of his experience there. So one of the boys he abused came from Sri Lanka. So they were sort of, they broke the mold in many ways. And they didn't really care what people thought. The extraordinary thing is that Mountbatten was quite open about his bisexuality. He talked about it in obituary programs, so that those bits were cut. It was a sort of open secret in their circles. But those secrets were kept, really, until I wrote this book.
So you've mentioned to us previously that he was a mentor to Prince Charles. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, there was a very close relationship with Prince Charles going back to the post-war period when Charles used to go out and see Mountbatten in Malta. In fact, there are lots of pictures of Dickie and Edwina Mountbatten with both Prince Charles and Princess Anne. The relationship in some ways went on to the next stage when Charles was serving in the Navy and was based down at Portsmouth, and Mountbatten gave him the use of a room at Broadlands where he could bring girlfriends. They spent a lot of time together chatting. Mountbatten saw his role as a sort of mentor to the prince, teaching him about kingship, giving him the attention that his father, Philip, really didn't give him. And Charles always called him his honorary grandfather, and indeed Charles was the one who gave the address at both the memorial and the funeral. The relationship didn't only just cover kingship, but also Charles's private life. And it was Mountbatten who said to Charles, you know, he should sow his wild oats, have lots of relationships with the woman, and then marry a virgin. And that is felt was the advice that Charles followed when he then settled down with Diana to tragic, not very good consequences. So it was indeed a very close relationship. When Charles heard that his great uncle had been murdered, he was fishing in Iceland. He immediately rang Balmoral and was deeply, deeply distressed by the whole thing.
So we have spoken about his death, but there are a couple of conspiracy theories involved in this. So can you tell us more about that?
Though the IRA took credit for killing Mountbatten, there are a number of theories that they were not involved. And indeed,
people that were charged were not involved. For example, Patrick McMahon, the only person to go to prison for it, and who was the IRA's chief bomb maker, was picked up before the bomb was actually detonated. He was picked up in a checkpoint. He was found to have gelignite on his fingers. Traces of paint from the boat were found on him. So on the forensic evidence, he was convicted, and he served 18 years before being released under the Good Friday Agreement. But he was only one of a team of six. Another chap called Francis McGurl was also charged, but was not. There was insufficient evidence to convict him, and he was let off. He died then in a mysterious tractor accident, supposedly involving the SAS. But over the years, various people have put forward theories the KGB were involved. Powell thought the CIA were involved. There was Patrick McMahon said that he took the rap for it in order to cover another plot from other people. There were claims that it wasn't the Provision IRA, but it was some splinter group that was involved. There is a lot of mystery. I mean, even one person in prison who claimed that Patrick McMahon had said that it was a British intelligence operation. It's certainly true that Mountbatten was under a great deal of threat that year. There'd just been the assassination of Erin Eve earlier in the year. The authorities knew there was a plan to kill him. Indeed, there were stories in Mullock Moor that people would not take Mountbatten out on his boat because they were worried. They'd heard stories about a bomb on the boat. And it is odd that though there had been an attempt to put a bomb on the boat the previous year, and it had always been under some sort of surveillance, that in 1979 there was no surveillance on the boat whatsoever, and it was an easy target. There was also a character I talked to called Graham Yule, who was a military policeman who was tasked in the summer of 1979 to do an intelligence audit or security audit on Mountbatten. And he raised the question of the boat not being guarded. He said that there were IRA activists in Mullock Moor, but nothing was done with this. And in fact, he was then taken off duties and posted to Hong Kong and told never to talk about it. So it looks like there was either a cock-up or some sort of conspiracy to withdraw the sort of security he'd been used to. The fact is, the Garda who were protecting him were not trained properly. They didn't go on the boat. They were watching from the clifftop when he was killed. And so there are a lot of mysteries. And the problem is, those mysteries won't be cleared up until the files are opened. And the files still, 40 years later, are closed.
I wonder how long they're going to stay. They're going to stay closed, because there's documents that I'm still waiting for that they closed again. And I will be in my late 70s when they apparently are reopened. So it's one of those things where I'm being a historian.
Exactly. No, it's very frustrating. I mean, I'm a great believer that, you know, all documents should be open, even with data protection provisions, within 50 years of the event, because how can we tell the story of our history if we haven't got the documents to look at?
Exactly. That was absolutely brilliant. I am actually going out and buying your book right now because I want to read more about Edwina. You've made me fall in love with her very much. So.
Okay.
I need to know more about her, basically.
Well, she is a great person. I'd love to do more about, do more on her. I think one of the problems is because she dies, three quarters of the way through the book, and there's less material on her. A lot of her papers are still closed. One has to do it from people's memories. And of course she died, 60 years ago. So there are not many people alive who remember her. But she is a remarkable figure, and so I'm sure you'll enjoy discovering more about her.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for asking me.
Join us on Monday when Linda Porter will be with us to talk all about Charles II's mistresses. We're not going to be talking about him, really, just the women themselves, who they were, where they came from, so don't miss that. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as a dollar a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.